Welcome, everybody. It's really good to see so many people here, and welcome to this joint Reuters Institute Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism lecture, which is taking place, as you can see, in St. Anthony's College here, but is taking place thanks to the support of Green Templeton's College Research Fund. And I'm delighted to welcome all of you, but also Nick Lemon, Dean of the Columbia School, Professor Michael Schutzen, and Paul Starr, Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs at Princeton, along with John Lloyd, Director of Journalism here at the Reuters Institute. And all of these people are very distinguished participants on the American side and the UK side, but let me talk about the US side first. Very distinguished participants in different ways in the burgeoning debate on the state of journalism on both sides of the Atlantic. Nick Lemon is a distinguished journalist in his own right, and he commissioned the report on the reconstruction of American journalism, which has become a key reference point for discussions on the state of the American media at the moment. Michael Schutzen, on my immediate right here, co-authored that report with his colleague Len Downey, formerly executive editor of the Washington Post, and actually who delivered the lecture here at the Reuters Institute, which launched the Institute in Oxford about 3 years ago, I think. Michael is also author of an arrestingly titled book called Why Democracies Need an Unlovable Press, which I think is probably recommended reading for UK politicians who are still reeling after the newspaper scandals about MPs' expenses here in the UK. Paul Starr, on the far right over there, is author of The Creation of the Media, as well as a recent study of liberalism, and some seminal essays on the state of US news, including one entitled Goodbye to the Age of Newspapers, Welcome to a New Era of Corruption, and another in this month's edition of The Atlantic with the topical title of Governing in the Age of Fox News. John Lloyd is my colleague, he's the founder of the Reuters Institute and my colleague in running the Institute and the programme of events and publications that we do. John's also, as many of you will know, a contributing editor of the Financial Times and author of a book on the British media that had a big influence on the debate here called What Are the Media Doing to Our Politics? So, I'm going to hand over, what we're going to do this evening is I'm going to hand over to Nick Lemon, who's going to introduce Michael and explain the background to the report that Michael will be presenting. Then Michael will deliver the lecture, and then we'll move on to a discussion of the issues that have been raised with this distinguished group of panellists, and then open up to discussion from all of you. So, over to Nick.
In the U.S., the sort of pulsing heart of journalism is a distributed set of about 25 big metropolitan daily newspapers, more so than here. And that group in American journalism has been pretty devastated. To the extent that members of this group collectively are listed in public stock exchanges as newspaper companies, at the worst, they had lost somewhere like 95% of their value, their market capitalization, in about 3 or 4 years. Lots of prominent bankruptcies. Newsrooms themselves in these especially big metro papers have been reduced by half or more than half in many cases. And as a result of both these developments and also life that one is in for as a journalism dean, I found myself involved in many, many, many conversations about what's going on in journalism and the future of journalism. A couple of things frustrated me about these conversations. Before I get to that, I felt our school, because of its place in the world, really had a kind of moral obligation to insert itself into this very important discussion. But beyond that, Paul's long story of about a year ago in the New Republic was by far the best single thing I'd seen up to that point. I found that the discussion was, first of all, very fragmented. There would be a often quite good article about one news organization, one idea for saving journalism, but I felt the need for a kind of overall, under one roof, assessment of what was going on. So that was one thing. It would necessarily become instantly dated, but at least at the moment it came out, it would cover the waterfront. Second, journalism is a very big and capacious term. Our special interest as a professional graduate school for journalists is in that part of journalism that in the report they call accountability journalism. That is, journalism as practiced by mostly full-time people who are mostly reporters or editors who edit original reporting on matters of public importance. So I wanted the report to be very broad, but also to be targeted on this social function, rather than getting into a lot of subsidiary questions about opinion journalism or about the economics of journalism and so on. Just about defining the social mission and professional mission, what state it's in, and if it needs new systems of support because the old systems seem to be melting away, what might they be? Two final quick points. First, my chart. Well, first, this is a report with two authors. I would joke, including to the authors, and this may not apply to the people in this room, but when the report was sort of being conceived and pitched to funders and so on, the joke was that half the people I met said, "Wow, Len Downey, but who's this other guy?" And the other half of the people I met said, "Wow, Michael Schutzen, but who's that other guy?" So it brings together two realms that are not enough brought together in the discourse about journalism, and that is the sort of scholarly and policy realm that Michael represents and the professional practice realm that Len, as longtime executive editor of the Washington Post, represents. I think the report shows, if you read it, the power of bringing both modes of thinking into a single place, and that was very important. Final thing is the charge I gave to the authors, besides what I've told you, is that they had to make recommendations, and they don't have the exact same personality as each other, but one thing they have in common is they each individually came to me and sort of said, "Please, please, please don't make me recommend anything. I hate recommending things." So I said, "No, I'm your mean editor, and you have to recommend things." And furthermore, that the recommendations have to be actual recommendations. That is, many of these conferences that I went to, and many of you, I'm sure, go to, would end with somebody saying, "Someone should really appoint a commission to study this and come up with recommendations." Or, "One day someone will invent the new business model, and then everything will be fine." What I wanted them to do is have a discrete number of actual recommendations, things they were calling for. As I reminded them, they don't have enough power to have to worry that the recommendations will be instantly adopted, so any future commission will surely consider them. But I wanted to move the conversation forward more vigorously than just a survey of the landscape would do, and I think it's done that quite effectively by being a little more provocative and policy-oriented than these reports usually are. The last thing is, just by way of further introducing Michael, in his life as a scholar, Michael has, he's a sociologist who wandered into studying this field pretty much by accident, but has managed to be a major voice in three areas that taken together are slightly different, but taken together sort of comprise the entire basket of consciousness about journalism and its role in the world. And those are the history of the profession itself, its economic bases, its norms and modes of conduct, and so on, to the role of publicity and free and disclosure and public information in society, whether or not it's produced by journalists, the whole idea of societies that run on much information being publicly available. And three, citizenship, and what citizenship means in a democracy, and to some extent what role information plays in the way a citizen who isn't a journalist lives her or his life. I would urge you to read all of Michael's work, but I can't think of anybody who brings those three concerns all of which are somewhere in the consciousness of all of us who are journalists together, as well as Michael. So it's been a pleasure to work with him, and it may have been a little bit of a shock for him to work on a quasi-journalistic deadline schedule and and have a sort of red-hot impact immediately, but he can tell you about that. So, Michael, I'll turn the mic over to you.
I know Len Downey, my co-author, would have been here too, except that he's someone who's faced up to or faced down presidents of the United States without fear, I think without fear, is now in his first semester of teaching at Arizona State and is afraid to miss a class, actually. And I want to thank Nick not just for the introduction, but for putting faith in this new team of two people who know very little about public policy. And we're anxious not to make recommendations. He's quite right about that. But we tried it anyway. The report, I assume most of you have not read, but it's easily available online, is like just about everything that Americans write about American journalism, focused exclusively on the United States. But we wrote it in recognition that the American situation today is part of worldwide developments. We kept in mind from the outset several lessons from beyond U.S. borders. One is that the Internet has internationalized the range of media available to everyday Americans. The British media scholar Jeremy Tunstall many years ago wrote a book entitled "The Media Are American," and then some 30 years later, he came out with another book called "The Media Were American." Now he could probably also write "The American Media Were American." Not only because the Germans and the Dutch own major American publishers, or because Carlos Slim, the Mexican multi-billionaire, loaned the New York Times $250 million, it's also because the American audience of the BBC, The Guardian, The Economist, The Financial Times has grown enormously through their availability online. Not very long ago, decisions in boardrooms of media companies were alert only to local and national competition, but now also to global competition. When The New York Times announced just a couple of weeks ago that its plans for online readers to pay to use the website, Alan Rusbridger practically dared them to move ahead so that The Guardian could become, as he said, the newspaper with the largest web English-speaking readership in the world. In some respects, the U.S. remains oblivious or resistant to developments and practices beyond its borders. Our report makes passing reference to European public service broadcasting, an institution that, even with the growth of commercial alternatives, has a tradition, a depth, and audience size and government sources of funding that Americans can scarcely comprehend. It will not surprise you, but it seems to have entirely escaped the notice of American journalists, that vibrant democracies exist that have both freedom of the press and substantial government support of news organizations. The American assumption that government funding will quickly destroy freedom of the press is a private American provincial fantasy. We knew this going into the report, but what we did not know is how passionately people cling to that fantasy. Our report was well received in many quarters, but our critics ignored much of the report and ignored five of our six proposals and concentrated their fire on the proposal that the federal government establish a fund to support innovations in local news coverage. Let me acknowledge that government funding does open the door to government control. But I found it amusing when a senior reporter for Newsweek asked me, "Don't you know that government funding means government control?" What was amusing is that he asked me that question on camera as we were taping a show for public television. That any government funding for the media is the beginning of the end of press freedom, to believe that, requires that you ignore that National Public Radio and PBS in the U.S. have operated for 40 years without yet having turned us into a slave state. You have to ignore the federal postal subsidies that since 1792 promoted the newspaper industry. And of course, you have to ignore most other democracies in the rest of the world. Just so, according to a statement 2 weeks ago by Harold Furthgut Roth, a former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. Direct government support of journalism, he wrote, is a foreign concept. That's not a compliment. He went on, the Soviet Union had Pravda and Izvestia. Every repressive regime in the world today controls some part of its national media and censors the rest. The question, of course, is not what repressive regimes do, but what democracies do. And what do democracies do? Many different things, it turns out, including subsidize the news media. Since the 1960s and 70s, the practice in Norway, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, France, and elsewhere of directly subsidizing newspapers, especially to shore up newspapers in local markets that are not competing very well with the community leader. And studies have found that the subsidized papers are not less, but slightly more inclined than the unsubsidized papers to criticize the government. Len Downey and I spent several days in London last summer and talked to reporters and editors at the BBC, Financial Times, The Times, and The Guardian to get an overview of how the British media were faring in the internet age. But 4 days of interviews did not make us authorities on the British media. Moreover, to be entirely frank, the size, the reach, the quality, the ambition of the BBC is so far beyond what is imaginable in the U.S. that we felt like we were visiting another planet. The BBC receives some £3.5 billion for license fees and additional government grants besides, say, $6 billion altogether. The U.S. government provides $400 million to public radio and television. So government support of the BBC is 15 times what the U.S. government provides, and if you put that in terms of per capita government support, it's about 75 times what the U.S. provides. The size and reach of the BBC, I understand, is not without its complications, and as both the BBC and British print media have moved online, suddenly organizations that operated in different realms were direct competitors with each other. And those who were not government subsidized were naturally grumbling about the one big gorilla that was government subsidized. At that time, it was not at all clear that there was consensus on what to do about that. But why should our understanding of the American scene focus on comparison to the UK rather than to other countries? The work of Daniel Hallin and Paolo Mancini convinces me that broad U.S.-European comparisons oversimplify complex relationships among political institutions and media institutions. That's a topic for a meeting here tomorrow. I say all of this to acknowledge that there is a U.S. centrism to our report, but I would add that we would never have been bold enough to recommend expanding government subsidies for the news media without an awareness that this has been done in liberal democracies elsewhere in the world in ways that enhance those democracies. So thanks a lot, my European friends, for getting us in such trouble with our American colleagues. But the interesting part of the U.S. response, or another interesting part, is not that we ran into a barrage of criticism, but there have been signs of interest in and close to the government. I don't mean to imply that our report produced that response. Some of these things were already underway as responses to the broad economic crisis in U.S. journalism. But notably, the Federal Communications Commission, I guess the closest equivalent here is Ofcom, has started an inquiry into what it might do to help support weakening American news institutions. The crisis in American journalism is serious, and so government officials and politicians, if not journalists, are looking for how they might help. how did we arrive at this present sad state of affairs where thousands of journalists have been thrown out of work in the past several years? Here's my two-minute history of American journalism history to get to that, how we've gotten to this point. There's been journalism in North America, in what was to become the United States, since Ben Franklin was a printer's apprentice in Boston, working for his big brother's paper. That paper was the second newspaper in the colonies. Friends of big brother James had tried to dissuade him from publishing it, one newspaper in their judgment being enough for America. The earliest American newspapers offered commentary, some satire, the printing of documents that the government wanted printed, items reprinted from the London press, and random reports from friends and acquaintances. There was no such thing as a paid reporter. There was very little one could call reporting at all, and there was nothing to call investigative reporting until the early 19th century. And when reporting began, it was conveyed through highly partisan newspapers that wrote about politics to rouse people to march for and vote for a particular party or candidate. In the late 19th century, the growth of advertising helped make possible a press more independent of party and congenial to the rise of professional reporting. This happy accident, as Clay Shirky has put it, that in his epigrammatic way, Walmart has been willing to pay for the Baghdad Bureau, is what has made it possible for the last century of the American press. The wedding of newspapers to advertisers seeking audiences produced so much profit that publishers could devote a small portion of their resources to holding government and other powerful institutions accountable to the law and to legitimate public expectations of integrity. Americans, in a way, subcontracted an essential building block of democratic life to commercial newspapers and later commercial broadcasting because advertisers did not object to a bit of serious public affairs reporting in the papers they supported. Now, two things should modify that story. First, there are still more than 1,400 daily newspapers in the United States, and only a dozen or so of them have ever had a Baghdad bureau or ever sent a reporter to Baghdad or have ever opened a foreign bureau anywhere. U.S. newspapers have been stunningly prosperous for more than a century, but they've consistently and dramatically underinvested in serious news coverage. Second, the emergence of a skeptical, critical, and aggressive accountability journalism dedicated not to partisan triumph but to a sense of public service is really a product of the 1960s and after. Profits were a necessary condition for this, but not a for this professionalism to emerge, but not a sufficient condition. Prosperity had to be supplemented by cultural changes that came with the 60s and 70s. The first was an increasingly widespread and fiercely defended professionalism. Meg Greenfield, a longtime editorial page editor of the Washington Post, began her career in journalism in Washington in 1961 and remembers back to those days where she says, "We, especially those of us in the journalism business, were much too gullible and complacent in the old days. Just as a matter of Republican principle, the hushed, reverential behavior, quiet, policy is being made here, had gotten out of hand. It encouraged public servants to believe they could get away with anything, and they did." For now, I'll let Greenfield's quick memoir of a radical change in the consciousness of journalists beginning in the 1960s stand in for all the others, but I can tell you that every study I know supports her observation that journalism, hardly faultless today, nonetheless became more independent of government and more committed to investigation and criticism from the Vietnam War on. Advertising-based prosperity did not produce good journalism by itself, and in too many cases did not produce good journalism at all. It required, in addition to profits, professionalism, and it required something else that also grew over the last 40 years, the presumption of publicness. Whether it was the televised presidential debates that began in 1960 or the Freedom of Information Act of 1966, the second in the world after Sweden's and 200 years before, or the National Environmental Policy Act of 1970, the requirement that new federally supported construction provide publicly available environmental impact statements for public comment before the construction takes place. All of this is part of what has become a demand for government transparency. So three P's are important, not just profits, but profits, professionalism, and the presumption of publicness. As some of us gather tomorrow to think through a comparative study of the future of news, we may be inclined to think of economic solutions to the pressing economic problems, but I mentioned the three P's here because I don't think economics should be our exclusive focus. It's important to have a larger political cultural context when we're looking at how journalism or accountability journalism is to be sustained. Back to, however, the economic crisis, and the economic crisis is severe. In the space of a few years, the number of journalists employed in newsrooms of daily newspapers around the country has been reduced from around just over 60,000 to somewhere in the 40,000s, probably at the low end of that. The number of reporters stationed full-time in state capitals has dropped from over 500 in 2003 to about 350 in 2009. Major newspapers, as Nick said, have cut their staffs in half. This includes papers like the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times, the Baltimore Sun, and others. Especially at the state and local levels, again, this goes back to Paul Starr's New Republic piece of last spring, the press is increasingly absent. Our report presents some of this evidence and proposes a set of recommendations to help fill the gap in democratic capacity that has opened up with the shrinking of the newspaper press. We believe a commercial press will continue, it will survive, but it will do so, as is already happening, in much reduced form. And this will be a particular problem in covering state and local affairs. Very quickly, we made six recommendations. One, changes in tax laws to make it easier for news organizations to convert to nonprofit status or to become low-profit limited liability corporations, or L3Cs. Two, we advocated significant new investment in local news reporting by national public radio-affiliated stations. The infrastructure is there. Some people at National Public Radio want this to happen. Additional funds are required. Three, we advocated increased philanthropic support for news organizations committed to local accountability reporting. Four, new initiatives by universities could also contribute to producing accountability news reporting directly from their journalism schools or other units in universities, directly for general media outlets. Five, we advocated the development of more accessible and comprehensive public information data banks that are already growing and are already being tapped by professional journalists and others. And six, this is where we got into trouble, that we proposed that the federal government institute a fund for the direct support of innovation in local news. Our emphasis on local reporting may be quite different from the focus in Europe. As I understand it, local or regional newspapers in the UK, at least, are suffering in ways not unlike what is happening in the US. But with rare exceptions, the regional press has never made a bid to national notice. In the United States, regional powerhouses like the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Miami Herald, the Dallas Morning News, the Boston Globe, the Philadelphia Inquirer, have broken important national stories, won Pulitzer Prizes, entered into the process of setting the national public agenda. The Charlotte Observer in North Carolina revealed a few years back the financial fraud in a major Christian evangelical television ministry. The Boston Globe uncovered a history of sexual abuse by priests in the Catholic Church that led to significant reforms in the church. The Chicago Tribune unearthed prosecutor misconduct in death penalty cases that led the governor of Illinois to suspend all executions in the state. And those are just instances, and there are many others, where newspaper investigations that began as local stories led to stories of national scope. Many others revealed local corruption, mismanagement, or crime with significant impact on their own communities. All of those newspapers today are shrinking their news budgets. What happens to a community when you subtract aggressive news coverage? A few studies suggest that government corruption increases. This is almost certainly true. We don't know, however, how much. If you had $1 million that you wanted to invest in cutting government corruption, would you hand it over to the local newspaper to hire a crack team of political reporters, or perhaps rehire those they just let go? Or would you give it to the city's district attorney to expand the white-collar crime unit? Or would you start an independent advocacy group to sue the government for violating open record laws? Or would you give it to a particularly energetic blogger? Our report found much to hope for, by the way, in small online startup organizations run by professional journalists, with or without significant public input, in a variety of professionally directed crowdsourcing operations. Small news organizations with modest funding can do and have been doing high-quality, high-impact accountability journalism. One estimate is that in a newspaper's budget, a traditional newspaper, about 70% of it goes to capital investment in the printing presses, ink, paper, and the trucks to deliver the newspapers. Newspapers, it has been said, are really part of the trucking business. Only 14% of their budget goes to producing the news content that they are so proud of and that is why we want them. The online operations, in contrast, can put 80 or 90% of their funds, not 14%, into the journalism itself. These are organizations like the prize-winning voiceofsandiego.org, practically the granddaddy of online startups in the U.S. It turns 5 years old this week, with about 12 journalists. Or Josh Marshall's acclaimed Talking Points memo that graduated from being a one-person blog to being a small news organization itself, with a number of high-profile journalistic achievements to its credit. These small organizations and some larger ones like ProPublica in New York, the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley, are already helping to subsidize the mainstream news media by working with newspapers, documentary news television, and radio, providing them well-reported stories free of charge and well-informed on-air commentary. Now, why should Len Downey and I have found this so encouraging? Recall the big picture. Newspapers still employ some 40,000 journalists. The online startups, at a top-level estimate, would be about 500. Why emphasize developments that, as of February 4th, 2010, provide such a modest percentage of the total news output? I think there's some good reasons. We're going to have more organizations like that. The barriers to entry are so minimal, they don't need delivery trucks. Newspapers take pride in their content, but what made them a financial success was they could deliver the content to your door. The online startups can do that too. Second, the productivity of an individual journalist is enormously increased by the internet and the personal computer. A couple of months ago at a conference, I heard the media business columnist at the New York Times, David Carr, go to the podium and return to the table. He came back to the podium and lifted his laptop over his head and said, "There are more resources here in my hand at this moment than in any newsroom I have ever worked in my 40 years in journalism." The increased efficiency in news reporting arises not only because the reporters have computers, but because governments, nonprofits, and others compile publicly available, downloadable, and usable databases. In other words, it comes from the cultural presumption of publicness I mentioned earlier. Even if advertising dollars had not dropped, even if circulation were not in decline, newspapers would no doubt be reducing the size of their staffs because they can produce the same quality of content with fewer reporters. Third, most of the online operations naturally take on an ethic of sharing rather than an ethic of exclusivity. I'll leave aside some examples here because I'm running low on time, but there are many examples of this, of the ways in which the online operations work with one another, work with mainstream media, work with universities to produce their output. Fourth, the online operations remind us how important is the resource of obsessive, endless, gritty enthusiasm. Yes, there does have to be a way for these individuals to pay their bills, ultimately. But they don't have to live in mansions. They don't have to dine on expense accounts. What they have to do, what they feel, it's their views, I'm telling you here, what they have to do is pursue work that gets the adrenaline going and makes them feel they are doing something that matters. If they can make money doing this, that's good for them, it's good for society, it's good for democracy. Many worthwhile pursuits have long endured without having a business model. There is no business model for a string quartet. And so even journalists, too, have often set up their alternative weeklies in the 1960s. They work for political magazines that aren't making any money. They start vegetarian newsletters. They find ways to make ends meet as freelance foreign correspondents. They lived and have lived often on a combination of passion and lowered expectations for comfort. With just about everyone I talk to at the new startups, whether 20-somethings at their first job or 50-somethings who had been laid off from the big newspaper in town, they talked about how this was the most fun that they had ever had. You could hear the blood pulsing. And while I emphasize that there's a vital online role for journalists, professional journalists working full-time at it, the online world makes possible entirely new dimensions of journalism for amateurs. I was struck by an obituary in the New York Times late in 2008 for the blogger Tanta, an influential voice on the mortgage collapse. Why was the New York Times writing an obit on a blogger from Ohio? Well, her posts analyzed what went wrong with the mortgage financing that was creating an enormous crisis in our economy, and her blog posts were followed very closely by insiders. They were cited with approval by Paul Krugman in his New York Times column. Who was this woman, Doris Dungy? An Ohio woman who worked in the mortgage business. No PhD, no relationship to any influential organization in Ohio or anywhere else. Just someone who knew one hell of a lot about mortgages. It's almost conceivable that she could have risen to this prominence without the internet, without the invention of blogging, and so forth. It's not that crowds have wisdom, but there are a lot of smart and knowledgeable people out there who can be tapped or who volunteer their services and are able to make their contributions visible as never before. It is all but miraculous. Fifth, there are non-market ways to assure the survival of worthwhile practices that could not survive if they had to trust only in the marketplace. Whether we're talking about the delivery of social services or the support of museums or music or theater, there is no business model. There is no market solution. There are tax-supported solutions, there are philanthropic solutions, and there are various blends of government support, philanthropy, and bake sales. In the U.S. context, it seems to me that even the feared and reviled government should be considered as a resource for funding journalism. These are matters on which much is at stake, and it's worth taking some risks. There is going to be a shift in the balance of where news reporting comes from the legacy media to a variety of hybrids and mixed and collaborative and mutualized efforts of old and new media and citizens at large. The journalism of the future is going to blur across economic sources, across styles of work, across the divide between professional and amateur. Let me close with a comment from a somewhat unlikely source. President Lyndon Johnson, in 1967, signed the Public Broadcasting Act into law and made a few surprising remarks when he did so. He called for not just a broadcast system, this is 43 years ago, but urged the country to build a great network for knowledge, one that employs every means of sending and storing information that the individual can use. He imagined a system in which a country doctor could get help from a distant laboratory or hospital. A scholar in Atlanta could draw instantly on a library in New York. He imagined creating what he called an electronic knowledge bank, and it would be not just national, it could involve other nations, in a partnership to share knowledge and to thus enrich all mankind. He remembered, however, how skeptical Henry David Thoreau had been in the 1840s about the telegraph, and Thoreau's remark that it is all very well to be constructing a telegraph to connect Maine to Texas, but it could well be that Maine and Texas have nothing to communicate to each other. We are eager to tunnel under the Atlantic, he wrote, but perchance the first news that will leak through the broad, flapping American ear will be that Princess Adelaide has the whooping cough. President Johnson quotes that, but then says, don't accept Thoreau's skepticism. Don't be a skeptic. Hard advice for an academic to approve of, but I think in this case I do approve of it. I do believe, Johnson added, that we have important things to say to one another, and we have the wisdom to match our technical genius. I hope he was right about that wisdom, and I hope we have the confidence to find out. Thanks.
That was a wonderful talk, Michael. When David Levy invited me to respond to Michael, he wasn't aware that Michael and I have been friends for almost 40 years since graduate school. I realize that's unbelievable because neither of us looks
that old.
Right. But I assure you it's true. And I've also known Nick Lemon almost that long. We not only have known each other, but we don't actually represent that wide a portion of the political spectrum in America. I have to confess this. David Levy could have invited many people, for example, who would have taken issue with the idea of government subsidies to journalism. I am not one of those people. I agree with Michael and with Nick that you can have government subsidies to journalism and preserve freedom of the press. And in fact, I testified before Congress several weeks ago, for the Joint Economic Committee of Congress, in support of that idea. But as we are among friends, let us be honest, there is no chance whatsoever there will be any such subsidies. The media are unpopular. Bailouts are unpopular. Bailouts for the media are unthinkably unpopular. There is no way this is going to happen. So even though I believe it is a good idea to advocate such things and to get people thinking about them, there's no prospect whatsoever that this is going to happen. And that's only one of several reasons why I feel it is my duty to pour a little bit of cold water on the high excitement that many of these initiatives going on can generate. And there are a lot of good things happening. I tell my students at Princeton that this is a tremendous time to be entering into this whole area. Whole new organizations, new genres of communication are being created. It's tremendously exciting for them to be able to get in at the beginning and to help shape that. But at the same time, we are in jeopardy of losing some very important institutions and values that those institutions have carried. And I would like to be able to say that it's all going to net out, that we're going to be able to reconstruct journalism, that we're going to be able to replace what we have lost. But I think there are good reasons to believe that in the American case especially, that there's a real risk of deterioration, a real threat to the way American democracy has worked in the past. And there are three respects in which I believe this may well be the case. And the first has to do with the public. The second has to do with the provision of news at the state and local level, as Michael mentioned. And then the third has to do with the capacity of the press to serve as a strong, independent force, independent of both the state and business. So the internet, as wonderful as it is dismembering the public. It's continuing a trend that has begun with cable television, but it is taking it to a much higher level. When people have read a newspaper, many people, of course, would buy a newspaper not because they're interested in political news, not because they're interested in public problems, because they're interested in the sports or the financial pages, or maybe they are interested in the comic strips or endless numbers of other things that an American metropolitan newspaper will provide them, and that's how those newspapers have created their large audiences, their public, over a long period of time. But online, if you're interested in those things, if you're interested in sports, if you're interested in business, if you're interested in puzzles or whatever, you go to sites that are specifically for that purpose. Those sites are free. They're often much better than what you could get at the local newspaper site. And those sites do not expose those who go to them at all to any news about the community or the world. And I think that is one of the reasons to be concerned about what is happening over the long term. We know from data going back now several decades that with each cohort, with each generation, there is diminished readership of newspapers, and there is diminished, as we say, consumption of news. It's just a terrible word, consumption of news. But the studies that are done of the extent to which people regularly get the news in one form or another, looking at all the media together, those studies indicate a significant decline among younger people, really a precipitous decline in the United States, and somewhat of a decline in many other societies as well. You put that generational change together with what is happening with the internet, and it suggests to me a long-term decline in the public, a long-term shrinkage of the public. So, yes, we may create some wonderful sites online for news, but they may not reach anything like the public that the news media, the traditional news media, have been able to reach. This diminished public for journalism is also likely to differ in composition a great deal from the public that journalism has had in the past. And here I think the work of my Princeton colleague Marcus Pryor on television is very instructive. Back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, during the era when television consisted of a relatively small number of channels in the United States as well as Europe, there was virtually a captive public for the news. And as a result, many people would come home from work, they would turn on the TV, they would watch the news. Many of those people might have preferred to watch entertainment at that time, but it wasn't available. As the number of channels increased, the people who preferred entertainment, many of them abandoned watching the news. There still is a public for the news. It's a diminished public. And when you look at the cable news public, it's a public that's much more committed to one ideological viewpoint or another. The remaining public, when you let go of the less politically interested, the remaining public tends to be a more partisan public. And that is, I think, exactly what is happening online. The online public for news, the people who are most interested, tend to be the ones most politically committed on one side or another. And in that process, as we move toward a system where there is more choice, we are, I think, moving back into a system where there is going to be higher level of partisanship in the news, dominance of partisan media. Now, that's not an impossible problem. I believe you can have a reconciliation of professionalism and partisanship, and we're going to have to figure out how to do that, because I think that's the world that we're going to live with in the future. So part of what concerns me about the report that Michael and Len Downey have written, is that they're really hoping to preserve a world of nonpartisan, independent, professional journalism, but under circumstances which I think are really not going to be very hospitable to that aim. What is happening that's most disturbing to me is what's going on at the local level in the United States, the collapse of support for journalism. And here is a very interesting study that just came out a few weeks ago from the Pew Research Center's Center for Project for Excellence in Journalism. This is a study of one metropolitan area in the United States, Baltimore, and of all the different media combined, online as well as traditional, to look at the entire news ecosystem. And the study finds that that much of the news that people receive contains no original reporting. I'm going to quote now from the report. Fully 8 out of 10 stories studied simply repeated or repackaged previously published information. And of the stories that did contain new information, nearly all, 95%, came from traditional media, most of them newspapers. These stories then tended to set the narrative agenda for the other media outlets. The local papers, however, are also offering less than they once did. For all of 2009, for instance, the Baltimore Sun, that's the remaining metropolitan paper in Baltimore, the Sun produced 32% fewer stories on any subject than it did in 1999, and 73% fewer stories than in 1991. And a comparison of one major story during the week that they studied intensively, this is about state budget cuts, found newspapers in the area produced only one-third as many stories in 2009 as they did the last time the state made a similar round of budget cuts in 1991, and so forth. So, yes, there are new online news sites, but if you look at the origination of news, most of the news is still originating from the traditional media. Those media are shrinking. There's more commentary about it, but the actual wellspring, the fountain, the source is drying up. And that is, I think, the threat to news and to democracy all across the United States. We need these new initiatives to prosper. I am all in favor of them. But we have to be realistic about them. And I just want to say one thing about public broadcasting in the United States, public television and public radio. Michael mentioned that in the course of his talk. And it is public radio in particular has become an essential source of news for Americans. National Public Radio has become a great institution. It's actually grown over the last decade. I hope it prospers and survives. But on the other hand, many of the public radio stations around the country are subject to pressure from the state governments that control them. And although public radio serves a tremendously valuable function, it has not been an aggressive source of investigative reporting. There's been almost none, in fact. I can't think of a single example. Maybe there is a single example, but I can't think of one where public radio or public television has broken some scandal, has conducted some investigation. They just don't do that. So there is reason to be concerned about the way in which, if we want public money to flow, and I think it's going to be very difficult to get any, but we have to be very concerned about the way that it does, because it can, in fact, inhibit the critical press. And we shouldn't just say, well, you know, they can live together. It's not necessarily the case. Now, I think Americans, perhaps even more than the British, are determinedly optimistic. I mean, it is part of the national character, Michael and I were at a conference at Yale in November, where I presented a similarly grim view of what was happening with journalism. And Jeff Jarvis, who takes the opposite view, was in the audience. And I later found that he tweeted during my talk that I was the Eeyore of the meeting. Well, I assure you, I am not innately disposed to a dour view of the world. I am, however, disposed to a realistic view of the world. And I would love to be convinced of the opposite. But at the moment, this is what I see. I see that there have been a number of deeply disturbing trends in American democracy over the last several decades, and I am very worried that this is going to intensify the problems.
Paul says that that Americans are inherently optimistic, and I will try also to be optimistic. Scots are well known as the optimistic. Optimistic race, and I wanted to talk a bit about the just I think 2 points. One is the controversial point in the report, in the Schutz and Danu report, which was the state funding. And as Paul has said, it's unlikely to happen, or if it does happen, it'll be very minor. It is more likely to happen here, and we are in the UK and in Europe, generally Western Europe, generally in the same boat, where in the US there's lots of failures or near failures in big city papers. The same thing is happening in Britain, that papers which were big city papers, like the Birmingham paper and the Leicester paper and the Bradford paper and the Bristol paper, dailies or evening papers, are now teetering on the brink. They've lost often as much as 50-60% of their readership in the last few. So we're in the same boat, and a number of voices here have been raised, Alan Rusbridger perhaps the most influential, but others in the Academy and elsewhere, for state funding. So it's perhaps more likely here because we have the BBC, we have a tradition of it, and therefore I want to echo Paul's point that one has to be careful about this. It isn't that we've had a bad experience with the BBC. On the contrary, the BBC, I think, has over the years become more independent, and is probably more independent now of government. The official historian of the BBC is in the audience, and she will either shoot me down or back me up on this, but probably my view is that it's more independent than it has been in its history. When one looks at the successive prime ministers who've battled with the BBC from the mid-1920s onwards, when it didn't have to, in a sense, battle with the BBC, because the BBC, during the general strike, as is well known, put itself more or less at the service of the government. But then throughout the 20s, 30s, during the war and afterwards, successive prime ministers and governments have tried to curb the BBC. Generally, they've been pulled back, but sometimes they've done some damage. So, but now we have got a state, I think, where we are. We have got a real jewel. It is a real jewel, and we spend 75 times more per head on the BBC, as Michael said, is a good thing, I think. However, it's not exactly unique. I think there are other organizations, state-backed, state-funded, public broadcasting systems in Scandinavia, in Germany, and so on, which have the same kind of independence, but it's not general. Paolo Mancini is in the audience. He can speak with authority about not just about Italy, but about much else, where the state leverage over what the state pays for, or the state raises from the public to pay for, is very considerable, and has not, in some cases, has not lessened. In some cases, it's even got worse. So we have to be careful when we say that we want public money to come in. It does, as Paul said, tend to constrain, or it can constrain, where there isn't the culture to support that independence. It does mean that the political class actually have to keep their hands off. It means restraint. It also means, and there are senior people from the BBC in the audience, I hope they come in on this, it seems to me, I've never worked for the BBC, one of the few people who haven't in journalism, because the BBC has something like 5,000 journalists, is that right?
7,000.
7,000, my God. 7,000, which is more, I think, than the rest of us put together. So there's a lot of journalists out there who owe their living to the BBC. But we who have, I've made my living on what used to be called Fleet Street for most of my adult life, not that I lived there, but I made my living from it, either at home or abroad, and one has to admit the constraint. I was very lucky, I'm lucky, in working for the Financial Times, whose owners really do keep their hands off it. But well within living memory, we had a press lord called Robert Maxwell. And Robert Maxwell was in the tradition, rather, of as it were, communist overlords who liked to have his picture in the paper a lot. And so here you had a stable of tabloids, Sunday and Daily, which would cover Robert Maxwell's trip to Bulgaria to speak to the Bulgarian president or Communist Party leader, and would give 4 or 5 pages of the Daily Mirror to this extraordinary event. That was in the 1980s. And although I think Rupert Murdoch really is not in that class, but it's rare to find in Rupert Murdoch's papers in this country or indeed elsewhere a good word about the BBC or indeed a good word about the European Union. So a free press and a free society. And in the UK, we have a pretty free press and it's a pretty free society. Nevertheless, the constraints of private ownership can be quite tight. The deal, I think, that the reason why the BBC, I think, has remained, and this, I suppose, is something of a template for publicly funded institutions, whether fully publicly funded or partially, is that it is free, it is fair, balanced, objective, and neutral. That is, it proclaims its neutrality as between left and right, between parties and so on. Now, that is a hugely contested area where successive governments, prime ministers, including this one and the Tony Blair government and before that, have generally seen the BBC as run either by communists or by radical conservatives, and in Harold Wilson's case, by both, it seemed, almost simultaneously, and have made their displeasure known to that. However, it does seem to me that what it's managed to do is to ingrain in the governing class a respect for it, which at least is a wary respect. That is, you can't really take it on. When a report came out in this country three, 4 years ago about a scandal, as the government saw it, of reporting on the BBC, the Hudden report, which came out very much in favour of the BBC, in favour of the government against the BBC, the government did not then use this report to launch an attack on the corporation. On the contrary, just let it go on. And my belief is that the BBC did not then, as it were, draw in its horns, become less investigative, less courageous in its reporting. But it does need to adhere to objective standards, the standards of neutrality. And again, as we've heard, as Michael was saying, and as Paul said, that's becoming more difficult. We live in a media age where, it's very obvious in America, but it's obvious elsewhere, where news is now becoming much more opinionated. And it's becoming more opinionated because opinion seems to sell better. It seems to get more audiences. Fox seems to be more successful than CNN, forcing CNN to then become shriller and more opinionated. And it seems to me that the retention of a principle of neutrality and objectivity in those corporations, those broadcasting corporations and elsewhere, in newspapers which adhere to that too, voluntarily, is becoming more difficult under greater pressure simply of the bottom line, of the market. One final point, and this is the optimistic point. One begins to see, I think, one begins to see, a kind of possible salvation for newspapers. That is that the successful newspapers are beginning to gather around them, as The Guardian obviously is, the Daily Mail is, through their website, a kind of community of common interest. It's well known that The Guardian now has something like, it is the second biggest, I think, news website.
I think it's better, bigger than the New York Times.
Actually, its editor said it was second to the New York Times, but it may not have surpassed it. Anyway, so here you are. Here you have a British liberal newspaper whose paper circulation is declining significantly, something like 300,000 now, I think, at the end of last year, and which is in real trouble financially, losing, I think, 50 or 60 million pounds in the last fiscal year, yet has a vast audience, which it never had before. In the last 5 or 10 years, it's got this vast American audience. The problem is monetizing it. Now, there may be salvation in Mr. Jobs' iPad. There may be some salvation in Mr. Murdoch's view or intent to charge for, not just for the Wall Street Journal content, but for all content, and every other newspaper is watching that with anxious anticipation, because they wish to follow it. It may be, although I think in the case of Murdoch, he'll be lucky, or the rest of us will be lucky, since news is so... Again, the BBC, in this case, the bloody BBC, is giving it away free, so we can't charge, and that I think will remain the case. And there are other free sites as well, as the BBC, which one can go to. Really, a last point. As I said, I've spent all my years, most of my adult years, on Fleet Street, and much of the culture of Fleet Street, which was wholly private, one of the most private places, as it were, not quite, but private public places one could think of, private in the sense that everything, it was private enterprise. It was a market, a very ferocious market between the newspapers, which had to sell every day on the newsstands in a way in which other countries didn't. And if that is passing, and it does seem to be passing, where 12, 13 newspapers battle it out every morning, where you had a very raucous, deeply irresponsible, celebrity and sex-obsessed tabloid press, if that is really passing, it gives me a pang, I must say. It gives me a pang that irresponsibility, that fun that one got and still gets from the tabloids, where one follows every movement of John Terry's affair with eager anticipation, that the tabloids are doing this, and as one tabloid editor said recently, Paul Dacre of the Mail, should do this, because if they don't do that kind of story, they will die, and then we'll lose something. I think we will lose something, and that's a pity. So it may well be the new era we're coming into, assuming we have some kind of business model, will be more responsible, will encourage better news, and already does offer through the internet vast amounts of information which we never had before. But something of the fun will have gone.
Okay, a wide range of questions there, two of different kinds about public funding and constraints that come with it. One about the nature of news and who's doing it, and one about technology, and one about who are the journalists and do they still have a trade or is it a profession? So I'm going to start with Michael and move on to Nick, and it's your freedom to choose which you can pick and choose as you see which one you'd like to deal with. It would be good if between the four of you, we cover everything.
Okay. These are all great comments and questions, and where to begin? I'll start with Tim's question about whether there would be codes requiring neutrality if there were government funding. I don't think so. I don't think we could get that to happen. What I think we could get to happen, and I say this because we have other sorts of models of government funding where it sort of happens, that there would, you could get a system something like, say, the National Science Foundation or National Institutes of Mental Health. They, to my knowledge, they don't have codes about who gets the money or codes of ethics, what they give that to the professionals in those areas. And so you have peer review of proposals to the government for government funding. And there hasn't been much talk about that as a model for funding of journalism. Journalism seems so much more fraught. But it's not like we don't have rather radically different philosophies about science, too, and what counts as science. We do. I'm sure that there are Americans who would love to see the National Science Foundation erased and so forth. It's not erased. It's an overwhelming influence on the funding of American science, and it works without any explicit culture. So I think you, by putting the professionals or some kind of review panels into the system, you could make it happen. Why should we do that at all when there's been, lots of public broadcasting systems don't work very well to produce original and investigative reporting, and certainly there's been very little in the American case. I'll simply retreat on that one to the premise of our set of recommendations, which is a set of recommendations, and that we're not resting our case for the future of news on any one of them. We do think the National Public Radio has had a significant influence, and we do think that it does have a setup, an establishment where there are all these local affiliates, hardly any of which do any local news reporting. Even if they just read what was in the paper that morning, it would be a step forward in many of those communities. And a relatively modest investment, seems to me, add 3 local news reporters per National Public Radio affiliate could make a big difference. So that's our hope. Maybe come back.
I'm going to call on the next person who speaks should be the one who deals with Gene's challenge. Okay. So I'm not sure which of you is about to do it, but Gene's challenge is that we're missing a lot of interesting things that are happening, especially by women in new media.
Well, I should say our school, by no special design, just by taking the best applicants, is very heavy female majority, as are all the leading journalism schools in the U.S. I don't know if that's also true here. Our school we haven't even picked the class for the next year. It'll be between 2/3 and 3/4 female. That we are pumping a lot of female journalists out into the bloodstream who may help define these issues. Usually, I want to circle back to some of the other issues. At a meeting like this, someone raises their hand, in the U.S. at least, and says, essentially, and this may be out there in the next round of questions, I'm a web person, and I don't get this. Crying over the death of the mainstream media. What's the problem here? There's more journalism than there's ever been. There's more creativity than there's ever been. You, as a citizen, have more access to more news than you ever have. The audience for news is higher than it's ever been. The ability to enter the business as a news producer is as high as it's ever been. So, I'm asking a question that wasn't asked by way of asking, in effect, some of the other questions, to say what's missing, and I think there's starting to be a little more consensus around this, even among the most starry-eyed internet advocates, that there's a certain little subspecies of journalism that's in original reporting on matters of public importance that isn't in this great proliferation of web journalism, and that does seem to be decreasing for the simple reason that it tends not to be efficiently produced in its entirety by crowdsourcing and other methods. It needs people who, as Michael says, are not very well paid and work out of passion, but who work all day and often into the night just doing that, for that social good or public good to be created and available to the citizens. So it's a subspecies of journalism. It didn't even exist in the days of the First Amendment and the great pamphleteers here and so on. But it's emerged, it is important, and the market is not supporting it. It's worth saying, as a counterweight to everything I've said about the wonders of the internet, almost all of this vast world of digital journalism online is operating at a loss financially, almost all. So it's a wonderful model for free journalism, and there is not the fabled new business model yet. A couple more words on public funding and how it may work or could work, and this is just an elaboration on what's in the report. Per what I just said, public funding streams, in my opinion, should be very targeted to this repertorial function, and they have not been in the U.S. up till now. Broadcasting in the U.S. used to be quite heavily regulated, or at least somewhat heavily regulated, as to content. That's gone away. That's the going away of, in particular, Tim, something called the Fairness Doctrine, is responsible for the rise of Fox News and so on. But even in the days of heavy regulation, the regulation was more on the side of sort of educational programming. There actually were requirements for agricultural programming with many local licenses. But the thinking was, you know, let's get a lot of people like you see on this panel on Sunday morning and give them some airtime to sort of gas bag about the issues of the day, not original reporting. So I think it would be important, and it might have good results, to target that. Second, I think in the U.S. the real danger of public funding, practically speaking, and I hope I'm right about this, would not be a sort of state control, but would be the one that you mentioned, and the one that you mentioned, John, boredom. That you would have this kind of very sober, responsible, audience-losing press without some of the excitement. And the way to handle these problems, I think, socially and economically, would be, and this is in the report, is you have a fund. The funds are directed, have to be directed toward original reporting, but within each community, they should be two things. One, divided among news organizations. A bad thing about the old system in America was 95% of the wonderful reporters in any metropolitan area tended to be sitting in one room, the newsroom of the big city newspaper. A better world would be they're sitting in 5 rooms or 10 rooms. You want some cohort effect or critical mass of reporters. You don't want it to be all individuals. But there should be a distribution to create a competitive news-creating environment. And second, in my preference, the public funds would only be part of the funds that each news organization received, not all the funds, so that it's a kind of mixed economy model, so that each news organization would have a very powerful market incentive, but would have a little push, particularly to do this kind of reporting, from the government. And one thing that's influenced me in that direction is coming out of the business into a university where we have that model. And we have lots of philanthropic support. The rest of the university, not so much the journalism school, has lots of government support. And believe me, I stay up at night sweating bullets over how many paying customers we'll get. So it is possible. You know, Jeff Jarvis at one of our meetings, the aforementioned Jeff Jarvis, got up and said, "You've given up. You've given up entirely." And my pushback on that is it is possible to have some explicit or implicit public support and also be incentivized to maximize your market income. And that's what we'd want to shoot for.
Okay. So on the Fairness Doctrine, which was a regulation of TV and radio stations, broadcast stations specifically, no, there is no chance it's going to be revived. There were some of the conservative talk radio people were saying the Democrats were going to bring back the Fairness Doctrine. Obama absolutely denied it during the campaign. And one of the reasons why it would be pointless to deny it is that the Supreme Court, as it's now constituted, would almost certainly strike it down. So there is no chance of bringing back the Fairness Act. Now, there is actually one area of American communications where the Fairness Doctrine actually still does apply, although it's not formulated as such, and that is public broadcasting. And this goes to the question earlier about whether there would be any rules that apply to public funding. Well, the one area where there is a rule about fairness is public TV and radio that do try to observe some neutrality. And
the word objectivity is in the enabling legislation.
Yeah. So that's the last refuge of that rule. I would just like to take this opportunity to respond to another question earlier about what is happening to the trade, the profession of journalism. And I think this applies more generally to writers across the board. The decline in publishing, in newspapers and so forth, is having a very severe impact on people trying to make a livelihood in this area. Freelance writers, others, the sources of pay are drying up, and I think the whole conception of journalism is going to be affected by this in the future. That it isn't going to be nearly as good a profession as it has been during these recent decades.
Okay, thank you, Paul. John, anything you want to come back on?
Three very brief points. Going back to Jean's point about women and her keen eye seeing that we were all men. It seems to me that the generation of women after me, we're now in their 20s or 30s, we went into journalism, are now, for the first time for women, really on more or less equal footing with men. I would be very surprised if the next editor of the Financial Times was not a woman. The two best journalists on the FT, I shouldn't say that, I will get back to my colleagues, but two of the best journalists on the FT, including one who almost uniquely in the financial press warned of the recession and kept on writing about it, not just, as it were, said, maybe it's going too far, but kept on saying this was a woman. And I would doubt very much if she is not destined for high editorial office. But it's that generation which I think is the first, actually, at least in this country. America perhaps is a little ahead in that, which have got a shot at the really big titles, and will be running much of the industry, I think, in the next generation. Assuming, of course, the industry is still there to be run, which may be the irony. On the point, Diane's point about India and China and the growth. I mean, it clearly is the case that in these enormous states, you have got enormous growth. But what I wonder is, in a way, putting the question back to you, is how far is that that in India and in China, in different ways, you have relatively low internet use, rapidly rising literacy, at least in India, again, as I understand it, and the formation in very different ways in both of a civil sphere, as it were, where people want news, comment, analysis in a way which they have not before and feel themselves empowered to use it. I'm very struck by the testimony of Reuters fellows in the last two or three years at the Reuters Institute from China, who have been quite different journalists with different points of view. Nevertheless, all testify to the fact that Chinese journalism is now taking on issues, especially perhaps of inequality, in ecology and elsewhere, where because of the loosening of the constraints and the need for newspapers and television channels to be profitable, that part which is not the party press has to be profitable and thus has much more freedom and is creating a public sphere in a way which we are familiar with and have been for decades, if not for centuries. So I wonder how far that comes. I mean, I think that's a rather optimistic thing. I mean, it's a good thing, but it means that they're in a quite different environment. And lastly,
and briefly,
I went to a concert the other night in which Daniel Barenboim addressed the audience, said he was going to play some Schoenberg, and said, remember before you leave that Schoenberg is good for you. Even if you don't enjoy it, it's good for you. A lot of the discussion on journalism now, it seems to be that we're losing something that is good for us. The public journalism, the kind that we value, not the tabloid stuff, is good for you. And it may be that there's some kind of illusion, a possible illusion, between the academic or educational sphere and journalism coming. But I'm struck by a friend of mine saying that there's two or three universities in this country, British universities, who are going to bid for local newspapers if they go out of business, that they will run them, or at least some form of them. And the good for you journalism, journalism in the public interest, may actually be saved in part at least by becoming part of the educational establishment.
Thank you, Nick. Michael,
just very briefly on John's point, we at Columbia are very actively working on that question, and I will say that at this stage of the operation, it's sort of frustrating to find exactly what the sweet spot is. The news organizations would love to have our students as unpaid labor to work as interns in their office. That's their opening bid. And then their next bid, and this is where the relationship has historically sat, is that journalism schools turn out kind of B and C evergreen stories, as they're called, about the wonderful, incident where the policeman found the cat under the house that nobody, and that can run any time, and journalism schools turn out that stuff. I would love to take on this grander mission, I and several other deans around the country in the U.S. are working very actively on trying to figure out how to do that, and there's some challenges along the way, which I won't talk about now. But I would be very happy if we could make that happen.
Michael, last word.
Last word. Go ahead. Okay. Two points. I think it was Mr. Neal's question earlier about professionalism. I don't think journalism is taking in various new sources of news, but I don't think it's really going to deprofessionalize. That it may be that the professionalization shifts somewhat from the large news organizations that are getting smaller toward the journalism schools that seem to still be getting lots of students, and where ethics and standards and so on about journalism are inculcated quite seriously. Last point, since Paul and I have known each other for a long time, as he says, is that it's very hard for me. I don't think there's anything Paul said that I really disagree with. Sort of on the evidence, there's reason for sobriety, but I would still say that it's too soon to be realistic. There's too much happening that's really very exciting to be quite ready to accept that.
Okay, Michael.